smoke weed. Really again, my party's all over before it began. You can pour me some old whiskey river, my friend. I'll never smoke weed with Willie again.
Scott Emmerich and Toby Keith. A perfect lead into my next guest. Her name is Emily Dufton. She's written a book called Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Marijuana is still illegal in the state of Missouri, although it's been decriminalized in some of the cities. Illinois, on the other side of the river, is one of 29 states with medical marijuana legal. The non-medical use of cannabis is legal in 8 states right now. And this was all because of a memo that was written in 2013 called the Cole Memorandum, which provided some protections from the enforcement of federal law. But last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded that memo. So is this the rise and fall and rise and fall again of marijuana? Emily, welcome to the show. What do you think?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I think that Sessions' actions a month after my book has been released, well, it was great for me, but for states, you know, who have passed legalization laws, it really has thrown a lot of confusion into the works. I think people are really unsure of exactly what's going to happen. Now, the benefit for states that have passed legalization laws, of course, is that 95% of drug arrests occur at the state level. And the Cole memo that got rescinded last week doesn't affect changes in state laws. It only affects, of course, how federal prosecutors go about, you know, basically targeting or penalizing major drug traffickers. And a lot of U.S. state attorneys have actually already spoken out against what Sessions has done, saying that, you know, the voters of our states have spoken and we would like to allow these laws to stand. So many are suggesting that it's more saber-rattling than anything else. But as legalization seems to spread and as a growing number of Americans seem to start to really approve of its effects, it does kind of create a lot of confusion and maybe a little bit of fear.
Yeah, the numbers that I see in national polls say it's like 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4 Americans say, you know what, just legalize the stuff now.
Yeah, 64% in the most recent Gallup poll, which is the highest it's ever been. It's really outstanding. And nearly 90% of Americans support access to medical marijuana.
Was it ever legal in the United States?
Not really. The first time it was truly criminalized on the federal level was through the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, which was pushed through by Harry Anslinger, who was sort of their first drug czar without the title. Prior to that, states were allowed to come up with their own laws as well, and some states criminalized it more than others. But even from the 1937 Tax Act, that wasn't setting up real laws or mandatory minimum sentences against it. That occurred in 1970 with the Controlled Substances Act, which was when marijuana was placed as a Schedule I drug. And in the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, passed in the wake of the crack epidemic, that's when the mandatory minimum statutes were set.
Yeah, I want to talk about what happened in the 80s, because I did not know this until I read your book. When I was in college 40 years ago, weed, I know it was very different than the weed that my daughter and others of her generation are smoking now, but weed was very, very different, but it was also prevalent. You could get it anywhere. If you were a college kid, everybody knew the guy to go to or the girl to go to or whoever you wanted. There were plenty of people who could get your weed anytime you wanted it. But then that became such a big deal in the 70s. You say that in the 80s, that's when we had the fall. The rise came earlier, and now here came the fall in the 80s. Well, explain what happened.
Yeah, so it's pretty remarkable. When we talk about legalization today, everyone acts like, wow, this is the first time America ever loosened its marijuana laws. But that's actually not true. Between 1973 and 1978, a dozen states decriminalized personal possession. And these are some even surprising states. Mississippi, for example. Minnesota. Oregon, of course, was the trailblazer there, as usual. But states decriminalized the personal possession. And people were really supportive of this. In fact, some of the activists who pushed through these laws thought, well, this is it. Legalization is going to be around the corner by 1980 at the latest. But they were a little premature in their ideas, because what happened was adolescent use rates started to skyrocket, and this really worried a growing number of parents who had never really seen their kids use this substance before, had no idea what the effects of marijuana might be on young bodies, and basically formed an entire grassroots parents' army to kind of overturn these laws. And they had an incredibly powerful ally in the incoming Reagan administration, with Nancy Reagan as first lady, who needed a platform, and the prevention of adolescent drug abuse was pretty popular and pretty powerful, and she went on it with gusto. So the fall of marijuana after that rise in the 1970s came when the discussion about marijuana use really changed, right? The idea behind decriminalization in the 1970s was that an adult had the right to use this drug in the privacy of his or her own home because they weren't hurting anybody else. But that conversation shifted in the 80s when it became centered on the danger marijuana posed to children as opposed to the rights of adults. Mm. The conversation shifted to children should have the right to grow up drug-free. And that totally renounced all of the decriminalization laws of the 70s and kind of geared us up for the drug war that we know and understand today.
The failed drug war, as I always call it. So let's address that question. In the 8 states where we have legal recreational marijuana, have we seen a commensurate increase in underage kids smoking weed?
No, and that's one of the best talking points that supporters of legalization have.
Yeah, there's the argument against all the parents' movement.
Exactly. Rates of adolescent marijuana use in legalized states have either stayed steady or they've decreased slightly. And there's a couple reasons for this. It's because if you have it being sold in legal dispensaries, of course there's bouncers in front of those places who check IDs. The corner dealer doesn't check IDs. So that prevents kids from buying it. It's very expensive because it's highly taxed. But the most prominent reason that I've heard is that kids don't want to smoke if their parents or their grandparents are. It's not cool anymore. So
it's the baby boomer backlash.
Declining adolescent marijuana use.
Yeah, it's the backlash against me and the other baby boomers. We were stoners 40 years ago. They don't want to do that.
Exactly.
It doesn't bother them when they're listening to an old Sgt. Pepper album, but that's maybe different. So, let's talk.
The Beatles are timeless.
Yeah, so is weed, Emily. You know that. And by the way, I stopped smoking it almost 40 years ago myself. So when I talk about smoking in the 70s, that was a long time ago, and I haven't had a puff since then. But let's talk about the 8 states, California becoming the latest of those just a week ago, where weed is legal for recreational purposes. We don't have any information yet on how that's doing in California because, January 1st, a week ago.
Right.
But how's it going in the other states, and in particular Colorado and Washington, which were the first two to the parakeets in the coal mine here, if you will?
Right. Well, it's an incredibly lucrative industry. It's doing very well. I think that Colorado brought in $500 million in taxes in 2017, and Washington, not quite as much, but close. And the remarkable thing about legalization is that it's not just creating money through sales, although of course it is, and the tax dollars are going to a wide variety of public service projects, such as building schools or increasing access to education, sometimes even access to health care. But the really remarkable thing is that as an industry, it's also producing an enormous number of jobs. Prior to California even opening its first store, 165,000 people were employed in the legal cannabis industry. That's more than the number of dental hygienists or bakers in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, it's huge. So, and these are people involved with deliveries, marketing, creating products like packages or boxes.
Not to mention the number of people making Doritos to satisfy the munchies.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a huge industry. It really does involve a lot of people. Now, unfortunately, it is entirely cash-based.
Yes, and this is something I wanted to talk to you about, because what Jeff Sessions did last week was really send a chill up the spine of everybody who's already in the legal weed business, because they were hoping that there could be a move to get the federal government off the back of the banks so that these businesses wouldn't have to remain cash-only. They're not allowed to have a checking or savings or business account right now, right?
Absolutely. Marijuana remains a Schedule I substance, which means it is federally illegal because the federal government thinks that it has a high potential for abuse and no recognized medical value. And most banks, of course, are also federally regulated. So they are really hesitant to get too close to an industry that the federal government also declares is illegal. That means that all of this money that's swirling around through employee sales, through paying taxes, through everything, is being conducted entirely in cash. So if you have $200,000 on you after, you know, a week of sales or something like that, you are a huge target for any number of criminal activities.
Right.
It's incredibly dangerous and very frightening.
What do we know about the science of marijuana? Because you still have people who are opposed to it and say, well, you know what, I think we still need more research on this. As you write in your book, we've done all the research there is. So what do we know now at the beginning of 2018 about the science of marijuana and its real effects on the human body?
Well, we know quite a bit, but I think actually there's even more to do, definitely more research to do. And the problem is that marijuana is, once again, a Schedule I substance. So it's very difficult to gain enough access to the drug to run clinical trials and studies to understand exactly how marijuana or CBD, its non-psychoactive component, can really treat the variety of illnesses that we see it treat. I'm sure we've all seen the videos on social media of the child given cannabis oil and the seizures stop and things like that. How it treats people dealing with chemotherapy or glaucoma, things like that. But the actual, like, okay, well, if you take this much and this is what it does and blah, 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 that actually remains fairly unknown, and that is also because of marijuana's continued Schedule I placement. It holds up not only the banking industry, recreational sales, but it throws a real wrench into the works for medical observation and discovery.
And on the other side of this, we have the criminal justice system, which has put how many people in prison for marijuana?
Oh, you know, the actual numbers, I don't have that off the top of my head, but certainly well into the millions.
And it's not an equal number of whites and blacks, is it?
No, it is not. No, it is not.
This is a real social justice problem, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and that has been the driving trend for why people support legalization laws. California was really only one of all of the laws, or all of the initiatives to pass these laws that said, we're doing this not just because we want to raise a whole lot of money in taxes. We're doing this because we care about the health and well-being of our population. And for 30 years, African Americans have been targeted excessively for these laws. They've been punished for using a drug that blacks and whites use in equal measure, but all of a sudden, it's all these African Americans who are going to jail. That's not right. It's unjust. And that has been the strongest argument for legalization. It is by far actually the strongest argument for legalization in the entire, 200-plus year history of marijuana in the United States.
Last week on his CNBC show, The Prophet, Marcos Lemonis dedicated an hour to a visit he took to Humboldt County, California, where there's an enormous population of people who grow weed and have been growing it for something like 50 years. What other areas of the country are big on pot farming now?
Humboldt County is definitely one of the largest, along with Mendocino and I think one more, the name I'm forgetting. That's known as the Emerald Triangle. In Northern California, and it has tons of small farms, family-run farms, and has sort of the agricultural area that's perfect for growing this particular crop. But for the most part, marijuana can be grown anywhere in the United States, and that's because indoor growing techniques have become so advanced over the past 30 years. Essentially, the drug war drove marijuana growing indoors through advancements in hydroponics and an understanding of the agricultural elements that go into it. You actually can grow marijuana anywhere in the United States, assuming you have access to the technology and equipment. Now, this is, of course, a very resource-heavy way of growing. Outdoors is probably preferable, but California still leads the way. The University University of Mississippi farm is where federal marijuana is grown, but UC marijuana...
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
The federal government says it's a Schedule I drug and nobody should have it, and yet the federal government is growing some in Mississippi?
In Mississippi, of all places. Yes, it is.
For what?
They have one farm at the University of Mississippi where federally grown marijuana is cultivated and used for a couple of different things. It is used for some scientific experiments, and it was also given to people like Robert Randall, the first federally recognized medical marijuana patient.
Oh,
he got
no.
all of his joints from the weed grown in Mississippi.
I remember that story. You know, an interesting part about what you were just talking about with family farms is homegrown weed is a way to keep us from being taken over by big pharma.
Exactly. And most state laws, not all of them, do allow for personal cultivation, usually up to 6 plants, 3 mature, 3 immature.
Okay. I you know, we started this whole thing, Emily, with a song about Willie Nelson. I'm curious, is there any single person who is the leader? Willie's not the leader of this. He's just a heavy user. But is there any single person who is the leader of the efforts to legalize and normalize smoking marijuana in this country?
I would be hard-pressed to name a single individual, and I think that's what makes this movement so powerful. Every state certainly has a couple of leaders. I live in D.C., and our leader for the legalization movement was a guy named Adam Eidinger, but he's not as well-known on the national stage. California has Steve D'Angelo, Dennis Perron, a wide variety of other people. But for the most part, I think it's because of the collective strength of so many people speaking out and saying that they truly believe legalization is not only a social justice initiative, but also something that would be, you know, healthy and lucrative for the American industry as a whole. That's what really gives this entire movement its sense of strength and power.
Yeah, well, for all the reasons we've discussed here, I wish the federal government would just get out of the business of worrying about this at all. They have more than enough to do in the drug department when it comes to opioids, which are literally killing people. I've never heard of marijuana literally killing somebody. But opioids are doing it on a daily basis, and it continues to be an ongoing problem. And you would think that my generation, the baby boomers, the ones who are now legislators around the country and supposedly are the leaders of this land, you'd think the people who grew up on pot and are now entering retirement and may need medical marijuana for their own aches and pains, you'd think that we could do a little bit better than we're doing.
The opioid crisis is truly terrifying, especially in the face of marijuana, which really, you know, it's true. There have been 0 recorded deaths of overdose from this drug, whereas there were 64,000 overdose deaths last year in 2017, with over 50,000 of those attributed to opioids. The problem right now is that pharmaceutical manufacturers, the people who produce those opioids, are actually lobbying very strongly against legalization measures because states that have medical or recreational marijuana legalized have a reduced number of opioid prescriptions written, and that cuts into these manufacturers' bottom lines. So in order to preserve their profits, they are funneling quite a bit of money into anti-legalization lobbying efforts. So the opioid crisis, while not being really focused on by the DOJ, is ultimately underwriting the battle against legalization. It's a really tricky, kind of disgusting situation.
The book is called Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. I suggest you buy 2 copies. Send one of them to Jeff Sessions. The author is Emily Dufton. She'd like to double her sales that way if we possibly can. Thanks for coming on today, Emily. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.